Welcome to Meridians.
I do not think that the radio waves I have discovered will have any practical application. Hello and welcome to Meridians, a podcast about history, science, and culture. And that is a quote from one Heinrich Hertz. I'm your host, Charlie Noble. I'll be your trail guide as we rip our way over the hills of time and space, learning about different things, traveling from a designated starting theme and worming our way to a final theme with information stitched together by cosmic coincidence or by pure destiny, depending on the flavor of life you live. Each episode is unique. And the only basic guiding principle of the show will be the connections between two things. So buy the ticket. Take the ride. Let's see how deep this rabbit hole goes. Okay, for our starting topic, lassos, we'll be starting our journey in the Iberian Peninsula, more specifically in the southern region of Spain known as Andalusia. Andalusia is a large region in southern Spain. Unlike the rest of Spain and the Iberian Peninsula, this area is and was a large agricultural region. The largest city in the region is Seville, and Seville's incredibly old. It has been populated for roughly 2,200 years. It is said to be founded by Hercules himself. And modern Seville has a population of around 700,000 people with a greater metropolitan area of around 1.5 million, and it's the fourth largest city in Spain overall. It's also the only inland port in Spain, and it's because it's up 80 kilometers up a river. And this city looks beautiful. The architecture is just amazing. There's churches, fountains, gardens, and old fortifications. It's really cool that this so much stuff still stands. It looks like a great place to visit if you like that kind of thing. I certainly do. And Seville has long been an important port city for Spain. The Guadalquivir River runs right through town and connects the city to the ocean. And the region around Seville has some of the best farmland in Europe. So let's go back in time now and take a more historical look at the area to get to our the point here. So starting at 711 CE, a culturally Muslim group known as the Umayyad Caliphate or the Al-Khilafa al-Umayyah invaded over and took over the Iberian Peninsula. And by Europeans, these guys were just known as the Moors, so I might just refer to them as the Moors from now on. I can kind of understand why they shortened that and just went with Moors. But over the course of 800 years, much of the Iberian Peninsula had been fought over by Muslims and Christians, and it started around 711 CE, like I said. So by 1469, power started to coalesce among the Christian Catholic Europeans, and there were several separate kingdoms, but by 1469 is a big year because two of the largest kingdoms united. But King Ferdinand II of Aragon, which is the northwest portion of the peninsula, he married Isabella of Castile, which is a centrally located kingdom. And this united two of the largest kingdoms in the Iberian Peninsula. So that gave them a lot of power. So at this point, the last Muslim stronghold was a region called Granada, or city of Granada, which was located in Andalusia. So the combined forces of Castile and Aragon began to reconquer Andalusia in the name of the Catholic Church. And by that I mean there were Catholic monarchs. And it basically means they're sponsored by the Catholic Church. Their rule, their marriage, they're representing the Catholic Church in some way. But it also gives them wide support of the people as well. The way I like to think of it is they're like a racing team, and their major sponsor is the Catholic Church. And imagine that if your major sponsor is somebody that everybody absolutely dedicates their life to. They're very religious people back then. And so all this conquering is just done in the name of God's will. I mean, really, it's just, you know, I'm sure there's some racial stuff involved in there too, but, you know, they didn't think about it that way. It was Muslims versus Christians, I think, back then. So this conquest began to spread across Andalusia by the Europeans, and the soldiers, mercenaries, and nobles were granted huge swaths of land as rewards for their service. And these large estates that they were granted would be known as haciendas. So throughout Andalusia, you'd find these large agricultural estates. And haciendas were basically just large farms. They grew wheat, olives, grapes, and they also had livestock, like cattle, horses, sheep, and goats. And managing this livestock fell to hired laborers known as vaqueros. And vaquero is just a Spanish word which means a herder of cattle. And it's derived from the Latin word vaca, meaning cow. And vaqueros would typically ride atop horses and look after the livestock. So we'll get back to the vaqueros in a second. Let's fast forward. 1492, the Spanish finally conquer Granada, and they have completed their conquest of Andalusia. So now they're officially the Spanish Empire, ruling over most of the Iberian Peninsula. So they're riding pretty high. Things are looking good for them. And that year should mean a lot, and it's not a coincidence why it would mean a lot, because that year, while Isabella was at a forward outpost in Santa Fe as the war was completed, she got a visit from a fellow by the name of Christopher Columbus. Now he originally had visited her in 1486 to propose a voyage to the East Indies, traveling west across the Atlantic. At the time, she passed that proposal on to a committee, probably focused on war. You know, it wasn't a big priority then. They wanted to get this peninsula conquered. But once Isabella and her husband had conquered the last remaining Muslim stronghold, Chris Puffy Explorer Pants didn't waste any time. He probably thought she would be more favorable to his proposal, and he was right. Of course he was right. She funded his expedition. So, of course, Christopher Columbus set sail, yada, yada. He discovered the Americas, started pillaging. You know, everybody's kind of heard this story. But so we'll kind of skip past that a little. We aren't going to cover Columbus's invasion of the New World and everything, but... So let's talk about the vibe in Spain. So they're hot off 800 years of war. They have crazy religious fervor, and they have zero sympathy for anyone non-Catholic at this point. And they all think they're doing God's will. So the native cultures of the New World just don't know how fucked they are. It's going to get real bad for them. You know, and through conquistadors like Columbus and others, the culture from the Spanish Empire would soon spread to Mexico, and along with that, the hacienda system. And of course, the vaqueros were part of that culture as well, so they would also come over. So think about it. You've got a major port in Seville, and the countryside outside of Seville have all these haciendas with farmers and vaqueros and nobles. And they start hearing about a new world across the ocean, or probably imagining the large wealth they could possess. So it's easy to see how that culture probably very quickly transplanted its way across the ocean. So let's hop across the pond known as the Atlantic and head to Mexico. Mexico City. It is the largest city in Mexico, and it is built atop of Tenochtitlan, an old Aztec city, the greatest city of the Aztec Empire. So Mexico City is one of the oldest cities in North America, and no surprise, and it's the capital and economic center of Mexico. And as a whole, Mexico's economy is the seventh largest agricultural exporter in the world. It doesn't surprise me at all. Shout out to their avocados. Mexico also has around 60.8 million acres of arable land, which, for comparison, that's about the size of the U.S. state of Georgia. But anyway, let's focus more towards our starting topic now. So the Spanish arrived in Mexico in 1519. And like I said, the haciendas and vaqueros became a transplanted part of Spanish culture in Mexico. But another thing they brought with them is horses. Horses had been extinct in North America since the end of the Ice Age of 10,000 years ago. and the reintroduction by the Spanish had a huge impact. The use of horses spread across North America very rapidly. I actually read a book about the Comanche a few years ago called Empire of the Summer Moon. The book explains how the Comanche owe much of their success to their reliance on horses. Before their use of horses, they were pretty much a small, unknown group of people from Wyoming with literally no fighting strength. They weren't much of a tribe at all. And just a few hundred years, the use of horses, they would rival the United States government and outwit them for decades. And that book is Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynne. Really great book if you want to learn about the Old West. So when you think about old Western movies, you know, where you see Native American tribes and cowboys and they're both riding horses, those Native Americans didn't have horses a few hundred years before that, 300-400 years before that. I didn't really think about that. You know, I just kind of thought horses had always been in North America because there's a lot of horse culture in North America, but it's really only since the Spanish brought them over in the 1500s. So the vaqueros in Mexico were usually a mixed race ancestry, mestizo, which is Spanish and Native American ancestry. And then you had mulatto, which is a mix of African and European ancestry. And the vaqueros developed excellent skills on horseback. I mean, they were good in Spain and they were really good in Mexico. They were experts at herding cattle, having developed these skills just over decades. And they would also be commonly called charros in Mexico as well. So, but we'll keep referring to them as vaqueros just so we're not being confusing here. But so what did a vaquero in Mexico look like? So they wore a large wide-brimmed hat known as a sombrero, you know, those giant hats, and a charro suit, as it was called. So it's basically a short jacket, and it'd have some metallic embellishments on it, and some really tight pants, and these tall, durable leather boots for riding. And you might be able to picture it. If you like Mexican food, you've probably seen like a painting or something on the wall at a Mexican restaurant, or just, there's a lot of really good Mexican art out there that depicts a charro suit. You know, a lot of people could probably picture it, but it's just kind of a pretty stylish outfit for a job where you're basically a ranch hand, you know, but I think they look pretty cool. So these vaqueros, they would be hired to keep the cattle from wandering off, move them to new grazing areas, and bring them in when it's time to slaughter. Really, their job was to move and control the herd, and they often didn't work in the same place forever. You know, they'd move from hacienda to hacienda, and their job was not easy. In other parts of the world, livestock were typically fenced in, and it would be much easier to control a herd, and they didn't really have anywhere to go because they had really good grasslands, you know. But the arid climate in Western North America and Mexico required a lot of land for grazing. So they had to be able to move these cattle over great distances. You just couldn't fence them in. And sometimes you'd be traveling for days, and the communal grazing areas were sometimes something that was also common back in Andalusia, though they didn't have nearly as wide open spaces as they did in the Americas. So the vaquero they're sort of the original cowboy. The word buckaroo is said to be derived from the word vaquero. It's very, you know, it's very similar. And in the United States, at least, the historical idea of a cowboy has long been a sort of romanticized occupation, you know. And, I mean, in the U.S., we have a whole genre of movies dedicated to old Western culture and cowboys. You know, it's kind of weird. It's not like we have any comparable genres, you know. Like, there's not a pirate genre in television. Yes, I just thought that was kind of weird. But maybe the closest thing would be like the fantasy genre with knights and kings and whatnot. But man, cowboys, westerns, there's a cultural obsession with that. There's every year there's a new Western movie that comes out in the United States, and a lot of them are pretty good, to be honest. But so over the centuries, these vaqueros developed better and better skills for catching and roping cattle. If a particular animal had wandered off, a vaquero would have to chase after him on horseback and get a rope around his neck and lead it back where it needed to be. So you can imagine how this could be very tricky. You know, you chase an animal down. Maybe you have to jump off your horse. Try not to spook either animal, your horse or the cattle you're trying to grab. carefully get some rope around its neck, and then hop back on your horse and off you go. So it'll be so much easier if you could stay on your horse, just throw a rope around the neck of the horse and quickly be on your way. I imagine it was a very valuable skill that must have spread very quickly. You know, just imagine the rugged guy, gaunt man on horseback with his hat tipped low, big wide-brimmed hat, riding into town out of nowhere. Everyone's standing at the door of the threshold, seeing who this new person showing up is. He starts working. Maybe he's working at the same hacienda you are, and you see how easily he can rope cattle by swinging a rope and magically getting around that horse's neck or around the cattle's neck, and it probably looked really cool, and you'd want to be able to do that yourself, right? You want to make your job easier. So this skill had to just spread like wildfire. And in Mexico, the lasso was called the riata or la riata. In the United States, they were known as the lasso or lariat. So truth be told, lassos have actually been around long before the vaqueros. They were used in Egypt, Mongolia, and Persia. I mean, it's a big surprise. It's a rope with a loop at the end. They've been used all over world history. It's just the cultural, what we think of lassos and how they're used in the United States mostly is associated with vaqueros and their development of their lassoing techniques, you know, down in Mexico. So I think we've delved into the backstory and the histories of lassos and the culture surrounding them. So let's talk about lassos in general and how they're used today. So a lasso is usually out of a stiff rope so that the loop will remain open when it's swung. And then, you know, they swing it around the neck and tighten it up. And I remember trying to swing a lasso when I was a kid, and it's really not that easy because you got that big open. There's definitely a lot of skill to it. And imagine trying to do that on horseback. So lassos are still commonly used today on ranches and farms for the same use they've always been used for. I mean, commonly people are going to see them used at a rodeo or demonstration these days, but the point is that they're still being used today for the same use that they've always been used for, which is, I think it's kind of cool. But to sort of segue away from lassos now, let's talk about some of the other things that ranchers and farmers use to control cattle. So they use whips, sticks, poles, commands, dogs, and cattle prods. And eventually they'd even use electric cattle prods. And with that, we are going to use electric cattle prods as our jumping off point to get ourselves a little bit closer to Sputnik. So we're getting there, I promise. So let's leave Mexico and all those sharp-dressed vaqueros and head to Wichita, Kansas and talk about the invention of the electric cattle prod. All right, so Wichita, Kansas. Population of Wichita, Kansas is about 397,000 people. The Wichita metro area has approximately 647,000 people as of 2020. And it's known for aircraft manufacturing that started around the 1920s. Companies like Cessna, Stearman built aircraft back then, and they still have manufacturing plants there. It's a major center for aircraft manufacturing in the United States. And you might think we're going to be talking about using aircraft to segue us closer to Sputnik, but you'd be wrong. So let's talk more about electric cattle prods now. So interesting thing is I was researching who the inventor of the electric cattle prod is. And Robert J. Kleberg of King Ranch, and he does deserve a lot of credit. In 1917, he started selling an electric cattle prod. And by the way, King Ranch is the largest ranch in North America, and it is huge. It's bigger than Rhode Island. It has over 800,000 acres. So he did invent a version of the electric cattle prod, but we're going to go back a little bit farther than that. There's some articles saying that Nikola Tesla invented it. I mean, he drew up some plans in the early 1900s, but he didn't actually make anything, so we'll not say him either. I mean, really, we should probably give the credit to Robert J. Kleberg, but let's go back a little bit farther to the 1890s. John M. Burton of Wichita, Kansas. He seems to be the first guy to submit any kind of patent for an electric cattle prod. So I found a patent submitted on May 13th of 1890 for an electrified rod submitted by John M. Burton of Wichita, Kansas. And the patent's pretty clear. Here's a short excerpt from the patent specifications. Figure 1 illustrates in longitudinal section an animal prod pole broken away at its body for the purpose of condensing the view, provided with an electrogalvanic apparatus. Figure 2 is a similar illustration of a prod pole provided with a dynamo-electric apparatus. Figure 3 is an exterior illustration of a complete prod pole. Figure 4 is a detailed view showing a portion of the mechanism of the dynamo-electric apparatus, and it goes on for pages. And I'll mention another excerpt from this patent shortly. But what's not clear to me is if John M. Burton actually built an electric cattle prod. I could not find any information about him actually building one. I saw announcements in newspapers that he received patents for. He was granted this patent for this electric rod, but it's not clear that he actually built one or sold them. I kind of wonder if he did build one and just never actually put it to market to be used, because he was a businessman, as we'll learn. So he had a good reason to invent an electric cattle prod too. He seems like the owner and member of the family that owned Burton Car Works, which was created in 1897. And by car back then, they meant a rail car for train cargo. These rail cars would often be used to haul cattle to market. And I found the address of one of their warehouses. It was the Burton Stock Car Building number 9 in Wichita. It's at 801 East 37th Street North in Wichita, Kansas. I tried to look at it in Google Street View. It kind of looks like the building's gone. There's kind of a fence in the way you can't really see, but there was an old photo I saw what the building is supposed to look like, and it does not look like that building's there anymore. It was located adjacent to some train tracks, which makes perfect sense. It's not like you're going to be manufacturing rail cars and then not having train tracks directly adjacent to your building. And the interesting thing is, this building would go on to be used at different times by Cessna and Stearman for aircraft manufacturing. I think in the 1915 was Cessna, and Stearman was like 1929. And here's an announcement about the company in 1887 from the Wichita Weekly Beacon, titled The Burton Stock Car Company. This company owns the celebrated improved feeding and watering cars in which neat cattle and horses are transported across the continent without unloading in transit. The animals being regularly fed, watered, and rested on the cars, gaining time in transit and combining humanity to the animal and economy to the shippers. And a reminder, this is an announcement for a company who also went on to submit a patent for an electric cattle prod just a few years later. But I think his intentions were actually kind of humane, if not economical. His patent also stated that and this is another excerpt from the patent, the ordinary prod poles are provided with sharp awls for piercing the animals and thus exciting them. And the result is that by such practice, vast quantities of hides are punctured each day, which not only injures the cattle and is cruel, but it ruins the hides to a great extent, causing many dollar loss. This invention is designed to take the place of such sharp-pointed poles, and instead of piercing the cattle, give them an electric shock, which will not injure their body or hides and will assuredly excite them for the required purpose. And with the cattle prod, it's a pretty safe assumption that John was thinking about an offshoot to the rail car business. You know, he would have certainly been familiar with loading and unloading of cattle from rail cars, and probably could see a need that he was trying to fill. And I don't know, it doesn't look like he was the sole owner of the stock car company or not, but he does seem to be the brains behind the operations, because it seems like all of the patents are in his name. And he's got several improvements to his rail cars that he was granted patents for over the years. And it sounds like the stock car business was a fairly respected business in the area. It really helped Wichita kickstart their manufacturing. They had 160 employees with a payroll of about $8,000 per month. in 1890, that's pretty good. And that came from an article about the company written only a few weeks before John Burton would have been awarded his patent. So they were really right in the thick of it of this business then. So anyway, let's move on now and talk more about like the modern cattle prod. So a cattle prod is a handheld, usually electrified device designed to prod or drive livestock, especially cattle. It delivers an electric shock to control or move the animals, and the device is typically rod-shaped and is used to encourage cattle to move in a specific direction or to maintain order during handling or transportation. After Googling proper usage of cattle prod, I found a video posted by D&B Supply on YouTube. Generally, they just seem like they're used to get cattle to move, you know? It's not too complicated. So let's just hear the narration, this really short clip narrated in this video.
When your cows are well-trained with a hot shot, you don't have to shock them all the time. You can just show it to them, and they usually respond and it'll go, or you can make the noise with your mouth, even just a bzzz, and a lot of times your cows will go as soon as they're trained.
Okay, so that's that. Nothing too special there, but the funny thing is the guy that's doing the narrating, he's actually holding a lasso while he's doing this narration, which I thought was kind of funny. These guys are trying to tell you how useful an electric cattle prod is when they're still using the old standby lasso, old faithful. So that's kind of funny. So here's something interesting about using an electric cattle prod is it can actually technically disrupt radio waves nearby. The same thing actually happens when doing stick welding. The cattle prod unintentionally can act as a spark gap transmitter. And now they don't disrupt for very long distance, but they can disrupt like a portable radio that's close by, or maybe if you're close to your car, you know, car radio. So you see, what happens is an electrically charged capacitance discharges through an electric spark across a spark gap between two conductors. The spark itself doesn't produce the radio waves or merely serves as a fast-acting switch to excite resonant radio frequencies oscillating electrical currents in the conductors of the attached circuit. The conductors radiate the energy in this oscillating current as radio waves. Yeah, makes total sense, right? Yeah, I didn't understand a word of that. I was just reading from a quote of how a spark gap transmitter works. So don't worry, this made me realize I don't know how radio waves work at all. And I'm a dork, so I wanted to figure it out, understand it, because I feel like I should know. My Wi-Fi, my cell phone signal, GPS, key fob, TV, garage door, all use them. So why don't we spend a little bit of time and take a closer look at this by making another shift away from lassos and cattle prods, and now let's talk about radio transmitters. All right, radio transmitters, a staple of our modern society, but how long have we been using them? Who discovered radio waves and who invented the radio transmitter? And so the discovery of the radio waves belongs to a German physicist, Heinrich Hertz, born in Hamburg, Germany. So throughout his life, he read scientific literature and conducted his own experiments. And he sounds like a fun dude. I would love to visit him and dork around with some of his experiments. I don't know. It just seems very like mad science kind of guy. And he just seems really excited, eager to learn from what I read about him. And while studying at the University of Berlin, he wrote this to his family. I cannot tell you how much more satisfaction it gives me to gain knowledge for myself and for others directly from nature, rather than merely learning from others and for myself alone. I really like that quote. That's kind of nice. In 1879, Hertz won a prize for demonstrating that electricity had inertia. And this led him to more research involving electricity. By 1886, Hertz began experimenting with sparks emitted across a gap in a short metal loop attached to an induction coil. I love this, just messing around with wires and sparks. An induction coil induction coils just used to provide that higher voltage spark. So he went on to conduct multiple experiments where he's positioning different wires at different distances and positions. And in 1887, he published On Electromagnetic Effects Produced by Electrical Disturbances in Insulators. What a good read. And in this publication, he demonstrated that electricity could produce a previously unknown type of electromagnetic radiation. And they were called Hertzian waves for a while, but eventually they were referred to as radio waves. And that's how he discovered them. So unfortunately, Hertz died on New Year's Day, 1894, from blood poisoning. He never really got to see the impact his work had on the world. So with that, let's talk about who invented the radio transmitter. And with that, we have to jump to Bologna, Italy. So the University of Bologna, Italy, in Professor Augusto Reihi was an expert in electromagnetic theory and was responsible for proving much of what Heinrich Hertz had published. And he even elaborated on Hertz's work. But at some point leading up to 1896, a young man by the name of Guglielmo Marconi started receiving lessons from Professor Reihi. He wasn't a student. He just he didn't have any academic background, but he was just really interested in becoming an inventor. And this professor, Augusto Reihi, obliged him, I guess. And he began doing Marconi began doing experiments himself with the object of determining whether it would be possible by means of Hertzian waves to transmit to a distance telegraphic signs and symbols without the aid of connecting wires. So Hertzian waves, aka radio waves. And in June of 1896, Marconi patented a system of wireless telegraphy. And it's clear that this was in no small part due to his help from Augusto Reihi. It does sound like Marconi was a tireless, determined experimenter, though, much like Heinrich Hertz, which is kind of cool. It's good then that he decided to study radio waves instead of trying to like reanimate corpses or something like Frankenstein, or make like a bunch of half human, half animal hybrids in an island or something from one of those, from one of those novels. But so, of course, his patent eventually was a huge success. And if you want to read a great book about this, I don't want to make a bunch of book recommendations in this episode, but I just happen to have read a few books on this. I'm not like some voracious reader, by the way. I just happened to have read a few books that coincided with the information I was studying. And but Thunderstruck by Eric Larson, it's a really interesting story. It's nonfiction, but the way he writes his nonfiction is like through letters and stuff, written historical letters that have been recovered. And he's able to wind this narrative, and you have to kind of remind yourself that this is nonfiction. The way he writes, it's so good. But anyway, just like that, radio waves revolutionized the world. And not unlike how the internet would revolutionize the world many years later. And it's just a reminder that how much crazy shit has happened in the past 150 years. There's just so much stuff, so much invention, war, you know, cultural changes. Like, it's just nuts. So let's get back to how radio waves actually work. You can actually make your own radio transmitter with things you have at home. So take a 9-volt battery and a coin and tune your radio to AM, and just where it's static, just so you can only hear static. Probably turn the volume up. Hold the battery and the coin close to your radio and start tapping the coin across both the positive and negative terminals, and you should hear a crackling sound coming from the radio. So that's a radio technically transmitting a radio wave. So here's what's happening. So let's say I have a long wire, longer wire, and I connect one end of the positive terminal and one end of the negative terminal of the battery. And the current is running through the wire. And when you run a current through a wire, it will create a magnetic field surrounding the wire. and the when the wire is connected or disconnected, that magnetic field is disrupted. Likewise, if you could suddenly change the current flowing through the wire, the magnetic field will also be getting disrupted. Any change in that magnetic field is going to disrupt it. And so every time the magnetic field around the wire is disrupted, the wire creates an electromagnetic field that gives off radio waves. So to send a signal, that wave is being changed at a certain frequency, and that's what it means for a signal to have a certain frequency. But that alone doesn't transmit information. You know, I mean, obviously you didn't, you know, I guess you could do like Morse code with the tapping of the, which is, you know, what they did back then. You know, that's what a telegraph would generally do. You know, and so they had to come out with ways to modulate and make the signal more useful. And so there was pulse wave modulation, amplitude modulation, which is AM, and then frequency modulation, and then later digital modulation. And satellites, they have different types of modulation as well. Typically, they have different types of specialized modulation that's probably better for the distances and what they're traveling through. So with that, now let's talk about satellites. They probably figured that was coming, right? There are 8,261 satellites orbiting the Earth as of January 2022. And I had to think about that number for a bit because I didn't really like it. That seems like a whole lot of crap whizzing around over our heads. And no, crap is right. Because of those 8,261 satellites, only 4,852 are even active. And that leaves 3,400 just satellites just floating around doing nothing. Space junk, you know, and they didn't even, I didn't even count those 2,000 Starlink satellites that were launched. They're small, but there's still 2,000 of them. So you can add another 2,000 to the active satellites total above. And really anything in orbit around the Earth is technically a satellite. You could technically put a futon in orbit around the Earth and it would technically be a satellite. But for the common term of satellite and for our purposes, when I refer to satellite, I mean a man-made artificial device used for communication or scientific research that orbits the Earth. And it's estimated that another 20,000 satellites will be placed into space before the end of the decade by 2030. That seems problematic. And the risk of collision is already growing. There's 30,000 pieces of space junk floating around that are at least 10 centimeters or larger. And they're going so fast. In order for an object to remain in low Earth orbit, it needs to be traveling at a speed of around 17,500 miles per hour. That's approximately 35 times faster than a passenger jet. And well, not all satellites are traveling in that low Earth orbit, the vast majority are. And I mean, space junk is no joke, you know. That's going to be a problem someday. But let's talk about a few surprising uses of satellites before we finally delve into Sputnik and talk about our final topic. So one interesting thing is that all maritime vessels above a certain size need to be broadcasting their position. I mean, when they're near shore, they can detect their signal by antennas on land, but when they're out in the ocean, satellites are used. So pirates and illegal fishermen, you know, in order to not be seen, they will turn off their beacons, or they might not have a beacon at all. But these high satellite resolution images can be compared with the locations of known beacons in order to spot these like dark vessels. So that's pretty cool that they can do that through software. And that's got to be a pretty recent advancement. So they should be able to start spotting these, you know, you hear in the news about like pirates attacking ships and stuff. They're going to be able to see that coming more and more and be able to prevent it a lot better in the future, which I thought that was pretty cool. I feel like Captain Phillips in that Tom Hanks movie could have used that little help from that. But anyway, now let's finally talk about Sputnik. And in order to talk about Sputnik, we need to talk about the man who made Sputnik happen, Sergei Korolev. Zhodomyr, Ukraine. Sergei Korolev is born in 1907, and this is located in the far northwest corner of Ukraine. Back then, it was part of the Russian Empire, so the Soviet Union didn't even exist when he was born. When Sergei was a kid, he saw an air show, which kind of inspired him to be an aeronautical engineer. Back then, an air show was probably really pretty wild. I mean, he was born in 1907, so if he was a kid, you know, that's the Wright brothers hadn't invented the airplane, but a decade before that, a couple decades, I can't remember exactly when. But at the same time as his interest in aircraft and engineering started to grow, so did the Russian Empire's interest in communism. By 1918, the Russian royal family was killed by the Bolsheviks. I mean, God, it's pretty brutal, but I know the Russian royal family weren't exactly saints themselves, but they marched the royal family down to the cellar of their house, all dressed up as if they were going to take a family photo, and they were all shot and bayoneted to death from the Bolsheviks. From then on, the Bolsheviks took control of this, and the Soviet Union was formed. Meanwhile, Korolev's interest in aircraft was getting more and more serious. By 1923, he joined the Society of Aviation and Aeronautical Navigation of Ukraine and Crimea, known as OAVUK, OAVUK. He started flying planes and then almost immediately started to design planes himself. He then joined a technical institute, the Kiev Polytechnic Institute, and he studied aeronautics there. He continued to study for years and was accepted into the State Technical Institute in Moscow, the BMSTU. And it was here that he began working under Andrei Tupolev as his mentor. And this guy would come up later in Korolev's life, and basically he'd save his ass. Around the same time that Korolev was finishing up his education, Stalin had begun to consolidate power. By 1927, he forced all of his rivals into exile, and he had total control over the empire. Korolev graduated around 1929, and he started to work on experimental aircraft for the USSR. He worked in the experimental section of the Aircraft Design Bureau, OPO-4. And he went on to work for the Central Aerodynamic Institute. And while he was there, he became very interested in finding the operational limits of aircraft. And this is probably where it's believed his interest in space began. Also, he became very interested in the idea of liquid-fueled rocket engines to propel planes. So while he was there, he became the lead engineer on the Tupolev TB-3 heavy bomber, which was later used by the Soviets in the Winter War in Finland, and then it was used in World War II as well. This plane, among many others, was named after his friend and mentor, Andrei Tupolev, who worked on this and many other aircraft. So let's fast forward a bit to 1931, and Korolev was involved in the creation of GERD, or the Group for the Study of Reactive Motion. This was one of the earliest centers for rocket development in the USSR. It was there he met a pilot and engineer named Mikhail Tikhonov, who would later work under Korolev and the Sputnik group. And Mikhail Tikhonov was a graduate of Zhukovsky Air Force Academy in 1925, and he would go on to work at GERD, developing rockets and working under Sergei Korolev there. And this guy would also come up later, as he was a key player in the Sputnik group, like I said. So in 1933, GERD was merged with the Gas Dynamics Laboratory, and the Reactive Science Institute was created. This was the preeminent group studying rockets in the Soviet Union. It was here that Korolev designed the cruise missiles and rocket-powered glider. And by this time, he was married and had a daughter around this time, but Korolev was very work-obsessed, and he clearly spent very long hours working, which would be detrimental for his health later in life. So now fast forward to 1937, And things, this is where things take a turn for the worse for Korolev and many people working for the RNII, that Research Institute, Reactive Scientific Research Institute. And so this is 10 years after Stalin had sent his rivals into exile. You know, he'd gotten rid of all of his rivals, all the group of people that had formed the Soviet Union. He was basically the leader now. And this is 10 years later, he decides he needs to consolidate his power further because Leon Trotsky still has some supporters and Stalin just wasn't having it. He called in his goons, the NKVD, which is basically the secret service of the Soviet Union, to round up anyone who was suspicious. And of course, things got out of hand and they started forcing confessions out of all kinds of people. You know, you torture somebody enough, you're going to get a confession out of them, you know. And so Sergei Korolev and many scientists and engineers at the RNII were just swept up in this. And Korolev was taken into custody and had a confession forced out of him. And then it was placed in the Gulag prison in 1938. So Mikhail Tikhonov was one of the few people who was not caught up in the 1932 purge by Stalin. Instead, Mikhail would go on to further develop rockets and weapons of war. Not sure why he escaped the fate of so many others. He just seemed to get really lucky. Maybe he just wasn't as high up and they weren't as concerned about him. It is really hard to say. But weirdly, this is bad timing. Weirdly, by the time Korolev was already heading off to Eastern Siberia, Stalin reversed his stance on the purge and immediately blamed the NKVD for overstepping. I mean, come on, give me a break. He had the two leaders of the NKVD executed, but by then it was basically too late. They'd gotten a confession and Korolev was in prison. I mean, this seems like some classic dictator move, you know, divide and conquer anyone around you. You know, maybe there was somebody at the NKVD who, you know, had too much power and maybe he was getting a lot of pushback for all the people he was throwing in jail. So he had to deflect from himself onto somebody else. He got everything he wanted and didn't lose any power in the process. So Korolev, he wrote many letters of appeal while he was at this gulag. He even wrote to Stalin himself. And finally, in 1939, the new leader of the NKVD decided Korolev deserved a retrial. But by then it was too late. He was long gone and he was in this labor camp. They could get to him. He spent several months in this labor camp and then another labor camp before finally word traveled that he was to stand retrial. And he endured really harsh conditions where many people starved and died at these gulag work camps. And this is where his health really starts to decline before he ever even started working on Sputnik, really. And he likely had a heart attack while at camp and lost most of his teeth from scurvy. And scurvy is just a lack of vitamin C that can cause severe gum disease. And he was only 32 around the time. You know, he's lost all his teeth. He's having heart attacks. It's not something that should be happening to a 32-year-old man. I can't imagine how much this place sucked. So finally, in late 1939, Korolev returns to Moscow, where his retrial was going to give him a reduced sentence and only 8 years. Woohoo! In that hellhole, 8 years seems pretty bad, you know, to have to go back to Gulag for 8 years. But luckily, his mentor, Andrei Tupolev, had stepped in at the right time. And he's the guy that worked with him and, you know, designed all those bomber planes. And he was able to get Korolev instead sent to a prison for scientists and engineers in 1940. And it was the same prison Andrei Tupolev himself had been sent to. So what the hell is a prison for scientists? You know, they were known as Sharaskas, and these were secret research and development labs, and they were under the supervision of the NKVD, those lovely bunch of people. And this particular Sharaska was actually known as Tupolovka, named after Andrei Tupolev, the most prominent scientist housed there. So the scientists at these labs would conduct research and publish, if they were ever published at all, you know, under the names of prominent scientists. The actual researchers doing, who were the prisoners, of course, they received none of the credit for their work at the time anyway. And like I said, likely their work wasn't published anyway, And all the better off as far as the NKVD and Stalin saw it. They didn't want the research getting out. And, you know, what better way to keep things secret than to just throw all the scientists in prison and have them do their work from there? Real, real great stuff from the Soviet Union back then. But from here on out, Korolev lived in fear of the government. You know, he was always afraid he was going to be executed because he held so much technical knowledge and in government secrets. And remember, he's working all the time now. He's been in a prison. He's in a Sharaska. He doesn't get to see his family. His health is not doing the best. And, you know, he's still a young man. And it wasn't until 1944 that Korolev was actually released from his Sharaska. He'd spent over 6 years in prison there. Of course, from here on out, he's not really free. Being released from prison doesn't seem to mean shit in the Soviet Union. Korolev was still fearing for his life and had to be wondering when he's going to be accused again or just thrown back in prison. He was thrown in prison for just the most frivolous thing in 1937. So strangely from here, he was granted the rank of colonel in the Soviet Red Army. Sounds about right. That's the usual path people take to get in their careers, right? Study, do some research, build some planes, get accused of espionage, get sent to a labor camp, forced to work in prison lab, and then bam, colonel. And he was even given a badge of honor even for his work on developing rocket motors for military aircraft. All right, so now we're in Nordhausen, Germany. It's 1946, World War II is over. Germany was divided into two, with the Allied forces controlling the western half and the Soviet Union controlling the east. It is kind of a funny twist of fate that World War II ended in the European theater with the Soviet Union and the Allied forces basically meeting in Berlin at very similar times. And as Colonel, Korolev was sent to Germany to recover technology from the V-2 rockets. And this always fascinated me. The German rocket program must have been something else. I mean, it's well known that the United States got several prominent rocket scientists, including Wernher von Braun and much of his research. And then the Soviets also got several scientists and information and plenty of information. It's messed up kind of way Hitler and the Nazis sort of jump-started the space race with the development of the V-2 rocket. The rocket was devastating to the Allied powers in World War II, and it was actually technically the first artificial object to travel into space in 1944. So not a great mark on history there that the first thing was a missile that went into space. But, you know, I do like something that was developed for war ended up being turned into something more positive, though. Like, it would have been better if it was just developed for science and space technology in the first place. But, you know, in any case. So they wanted to recreate the German V-2 rocket. The Soviets did. And in Germany, the Soviets formed the Institut Nordhausen. Korolev was actually the chief engineer, and his station in life was really starting to shift now. He was gaining some serious credibility, and Stalin even made rocket and missile development a national priority by decree. So during this time, Korolev formed a council of chief designers, and this group would eventually become the engineering body of the early Soviet space program. So he's kind of almost like the father of the Soviet space program, I would say. And Korolev didn't return from Germany until 1947. He'll spend more time away from his family than he already had, where he was still in charge of redesigning the V-2 rocket. And they were successful in their attempts. And later that year, the first test of the Soviet version of the V-2 rocket started. Their version was known as the R-1. With the success of this, Korolev then headed up the development of the R-2, which was what Korolev wanted to develop in the first place. He thought the R-1 program was kind of a waste of time. The R-2 was a huge improvement over the R-1. The R-1 already had a range of 270 kilometers. The R-2's range would be over twice as far at 576 kilometers. And then shortly after that, they developed the R-3, which had an insane range of 3,000 kilometers. You know, just unheard of. Which was a big deal because it could target England. And however, the R-3 program was canceled in 1952 because they couldn't get the amount of thrust they needed from the rocket. So maybe 3,000 kilometers was never really within reach, you know? A lot of smoke blowing there. But from here, Korolev developed the R5, and then finally, Korolev developed the world's first ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile. And that was known as the R7 Semyorka. This was a really big deal at the time because it could theoretically carry a nuclear warhead 7,000 kilometers, which is about 4,300 miles. And that brings us to Baikonur Cosmodrome. All right, so we're in Baikonur, Kazakhstan, and there have been over 1,500 space launches and more than 100 ballistic missile launches from the Baikonur Cosmodrome since when it was first set up in 1955. The first thing to launch from the Cosmodrome was actually the R-7 Semyorka. Since testing missiles back in the 50s, it has since become a major spaceport, and for a while it was the major spaceport, as cosmonauts and astronauts alike both were sent to International Space Station from here. And Korolev's rocket tests would primarily be from this location for the rest of his career. The first three tests of the R-7 Semyorka, they actually failed, and it was hugely demoralizing for Korolev and the rest of his team. It had to be, usually it's three strikes, you're out. However, the fourth test, conducted in 1957, was a success, creating a huge win for Korolev and his team. It had to be a very good day for them, you know. And if you get a chance, take a look at pictures of the R-7 Semyorka online. And it looks so much like the Soyuz rocket that's used today. You know, I've seen, space launches from when they were sending up cosmonauts and astronauts to the International Space Station. The Soyuz has a very distinct look to it. The R-7 Semyorka looks a lot like that. And the R-7 was never actually considered a practical weapon. So it was never put into use for war. But it still gave Korolev a huge amount of credibility. And now they have this really fantastically powerful rocket that they want. Obviously, they're going to want to use it. So another good thing happened for Korolev that year. The government declared that Korolev was fully rehabilitated and that his prison sentence had been unjust. You think? You fucking think? Really? Yeah. So probably the government is trying to paint a more positive light because this guy is a rising star. There's probably certain people, they don't want to piss him off. He's probably got some power now. And he's also rubbing shoulders with some powerful people. So now remember Mikhail Tikhonov? Well, he was the pilot and engineer that Korolev worked with at GERD and what became RNII. Tikhonov never went to the Gulag or Sharaska, you know. Instead, he kept developing the accuracy of Soviet rockets for the war effort. And so by 1946, Mikhail would be the deputy chief of NII-4, which meant Scientific Research Institute number 4. I love that, by the way. It's just, there's so many things like that, like just number, office number 5, you know, things like that. It's like, okay, yeah, I guess don't come up with, I mean, maybe it's better than having like, you know, Rolling Vistas or, you know, naming your apartment complex something named after a river and there's no river in sight. But, you know, anyway, I digress. Korolev submitted a proposal to use the R-7 rocket to launch a satellite into space. He cited work done by Tikhonov and also mentioned work being done, carried out by the Americans in his proposal. This is great. Here's the letter dated May 26th, 1954 to Soviet leadership. And it's titled Letter by S.P. Korolev with Enclosed Report by Tikhonov on the Possibility of the Development of an Artificial Satellite. At your instruction, I am submitting a memorandum of Comrade M.K. Tikhonov on an artificial Earth satellite, and also translated material about work in this field being done in the USA. At this time, the development of a new article allows us to speak of the possibility of creating an artificial Earth satellite in the next few years. The terminal velocity of 8,000 meters per second, which the satellite needs, might be reached by some reduction of the weight of the payload. The article, a satellite, might be developed based on the new article, rocket, mentioned above being created right now. However, with serious redesign of the latter, the rocket. It seems to me that the present time, the organization of a scientific research department to conduct the first exploratory work on a satellite and the more detailed elaboration of a set of questions connected with this problem would be timely and advisable. I request your decision. Hey, let me make a satellite. It sounds like a really smart thing we should do. And we can do it because we have a badass rocket. Basically what he said. Yeah, could have saved him some time. But anyway, his proposal was accepted, but he did not get enthusiastic support. With all the enthusiasm of the letter, I can't imagine why they didn't give him everything he wanted, writing with such charisma and panache. But Korolev was allowed to initiate a small research project, and we'd be working in conjunction with Tikhonov. And to gain more support for his project, and I find this kind of funny, Korolev started writing speculative articles for Soviet newspapers on spaceflight. So he wanted to gain the attention of the Soviet leadership, and he made it a point on the prestige of being the first nation to launch a satellite. His articles actually had a side effect in that they tipped off the United States that the Soviets were interested in making a satellite. You know, oh my God, we need to do that too. And helped spur them to start their own program to get a satellite into space. But then Korolev then used this information. He submitted newspaper reports from the United States with his proposals to influence the Soviet leadership. And I just love that. He totally played everybody and got his way. That trick, it worked. And his proposal to use the R7 satellite was approved. I really wonder if he understood the irony of manipulating and using propaganda on the leadership of the Soviet Union. I feel like he's smarter. He really played them. And bravo, sir. But a little side note. At this point, Joseph Stalin, oh, he's dead. Oh, too bad. He died in 1953, and then Georgi Maximilianovich Malenkov briefly held power before he resigned, and soon after, Nikita Khrushchev became the party chairman. This was great for Korolev, because Khrushchev was a fellow Ukrainian. Now, by 1956, Korolev had all the support he needed. So now Korolev has put himself under immense pressure, though. He started the clock in the race to put a satellite into space. I mean, he started the space race. I mean, there's no denying it. That letter he wrote really kicked things off, it would seem. And all those speculative articles really stirred the pot enough. So now, but now he's basically a race against time to beat the USA in launching a satellite. So he can't be sleeping well at night. And, you know, considering all his other health problems, and the guy is just a work-obsessed person anyway, and now he's put so much pressure on himself. And so now midway through 1956, Korolev's project was falling behind. This is probably due to Tikhonov's contribution to the plan for the satellite to have a more ambitious, it was a more ambitious satellite and be outfitted with scientific instruments. It was codenamed Object D. Such, you know, here we go. Then another inspiring name from the Soviet Union. And it was surprised that the first satellite was, I was just surprised that it was so ambitious. And for them to want to put such a completed thing into space right out the gate shows their level of intensity. I mean, this Object D was a lab. It's like a space lab with instruments on it. It was going to be 200 or 300 kilograms. I mean, it wasn't going to have people on it. It was just going to have a lot of instruments on it. It was going to study astronomy, physics, biology in their first satellite. I mean, bravo, great for being ambitious, but it's too bad they did have to scrub that plan. It was just proving too complicated and it was falling behind. I'm sure it was driving Korolev nuts, but yeah, it seemed like he wanted to do that too. I mean, he is scientifically inclined. I'm sure he wanted this as much as anybody else. It wasn't like this Tikhonov guy just wants to build this crazy thing and it's not possible. It seems like most of them were on board to do it. It just wasn't going to be feasible in the time they had. So the new plan for the satellite would be a simple metal sphere that was only the size of a beach ball, and the only payload it had was a small, low-powered radio transmitter. And the satellite itself was not really that groundbreaking technology. Really getting into space was the groundbreaking technology. It was just really just a simple radio transmitter. So now they had the rocket, they had their satellite, and boom, on October 4th, 1957, 2 days before it was actually scheduled to launch, Sputnik 1 was launched into space, becoming the first artificial satellite of Earth. And if you're wondering, Sputnik literally means satellite. So they named their first satellite Satellite 1. They just had just amazing wordsmiths over there at the time. I mean, wow. And they launched the satellite 2 days early because they didn't want the Americans to find out about their launch date and jump the gun. So they were right to worry. The United States did launch its first satellite January 31st, 1958. So only about 4 months later. As big of a milestone as Sputnik was, you know, it was a massive success, but it wasn't Korolev's biggest achievement. He went on to have massive success in the Soviet space program, by then also beating the Americans to space again when they put Yuri Gagarin in orbit in 1961. And Korolev, you know, he would pursue his goals in space until his sudden death in 1966. It's kind of he died on an operating table during a routine operation. You know, there's actually several stories about what happened to him. I'm sure there's conspiracy theories out there, but it's understood that his weak heart contributed to this death. The actual cause is kind of unclear. It's not agreed upon. I just wonder what could have happened if he had not died. Think about it. He died in 1966. The United States beat the Russians to space, to the moon, in 1969. If Korolev hadn't died, would their space program have still had the wind in its sails to have gotten to the moon? Because they were close. It just makes me wonder. Anyway, while doing all this research, it really is too bad that so much of history and innovation is just tied with war. You know, so much wonder and misery just all tangled up. And this is kind of probably going to be a common theme in this show. I'm sure it is. The history of war is the history of humanity, really, after all. And that's unfortunately who we were, and actually who we are to some degree. But the optimist in me believes we are changing. You know, we've never been connected like we are now. I think we are right in the middle of a crazy adjustment period where cultures are melting into one another, and that is in no small part thanks to innovations like the radio and satellites like Sputnik. And so that's that. That is our episode today. Let's do a quick character summary before closing out. So we've got King Ferdinand II of Aragon and Isabella I of Castile, the conquerors of Spain, and would go on to lead terrible genocide with Spanish Inquisition. Nice legacy, guys. You know, you should really talk to your publicist about that. And then there's the John M. Burton, the little-known railcar builder who leased the idea and patent for an electric cattle prod. I like to think that he actually built one and just never, or at least he tried to build one maybe, you know. I just can't imagine he didn't try to build one, but he certainly didn't sell them. He wanted to treat animals in a more humane way or just get rich off of them, you know, who knows. and then there's, scientific heroes like Heinrich Hertz, the person who discovered radio waves by being the persistent experimenter that he was. And then also another persistent experimenter, Guglielmo Marconi, the common man who took the world wireless and connected us like we've never been connected. You know, he did it without a college degree. So good for him, you know, no student loan debt. And then there's Joseph Stalin, piece of shit. And then Sergei Korolev, one of the most important men in the innovation of space travel. You know, I like to think that, I hope in 100 years, everybody knows who Sergei Korolev is and nobody knows who Joseph Stalin is. Cause I mean, fuck that guy. From Spain to Mexico, Kansas, Germany, Italy, the Ukraine, Moscow, Kazakhstan, and finally space. Thank you so much for riding along on this one. Hope it wasn't just a mad hallucination your ears will later need comfort from. Lassos, cattle prods, radio waves, and satellites. All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen. Subscribe if you want to hear more stories. This episode is part of the inaugural 3-episode series of Meridians. I'm going to learn as much as I can from these 3 episodes and hopefully put together a show that is worth listening to. I love feedback. If you have any questions, comments, or want to report any corrections, please email feedback@meridianspodcast.com. I really do take corrections seriously. I'm going to keep working to make this podcast an ever better show. Like saying the word podcast instead of podcast. But anyway, now thank yous. Thanks to my son Julian for helping me out editing, my wife Jenny for her moral support, and a special thanks to Eleanor Rigby, our dog, our good beaker, for being the best girl. My name is Charlie Noble. Thanks again for listening. Be good to each other out there.
Thanks for listening.